Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hey, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Today, we'll be talking to Donald Lantrum, author of his latest book, One Friday in April, A Story of Suicide and Survival. It's a memoir, a nonfiction work that's being released as we speak today, October 12th. Donald's been a very frequent contributor to The New Yorker, and I've followed him through the years since my subscription to The New Yorker started more than half a century ago. And most of those stories, maybe all of them, were included in his book of stories, The Emerald Light in the Air. Donald is the author of Elect Mr. Robinson for a Better World, The Hundred Brothers, and The Verificationist, as well as another memoir about his mom, who also appears frequently in Friday. That book was The Afterlife. Oh, and also, I think, still scheduled, is his virtual appearance at the Philadelphia Free Library, about half an hour from here, on October 21st at 7:30. And I think it's free, but I think if you pay $29, you get the book, the ticket, and a signed book plate. So it's clear, if you've read his earlier work, that the new one, this one, was informed by it, or perhaps it's the other way around. This book actually may have informed much of his previous work. So suicide is something that, especially in our time, is a topic that's really hard to escape. For example, in the past year, I have known four people, one of whom worked for me and was a 17-year-old young lady, who have killed themselves. I told this to a psychoanalyst and he said, "So what else is new?" Which was really off-putting. One Friday in April posits a fascinating question about the idea of ending everything. Is the decision based on depression or anxiety or panic, or is suicide itself at times a lifelong condition, which may not be diagnosed as such in the DSM-5, but maybe a different way of looking at why we want to opt out of this universe for either nothing or perhaps another one where things may be different. Welcome, Donald, and thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
So, since I own a bookstore, and even though it's supposedly not true, everyone judges the book by its cover. So your cover is interesting because it's essentially a mirror image of itself. And I wonder whether you vetted that, whether you came up with that, and actually the rationale behind that. I can kind of see it, but tell our readers about that.
I can kind of see it too. I didn't come up with it. It was one of the designers at Norton who did, and we all liked it. I guess it's could represent or symbolize the self in suicide and then in public, for instance, the way one seems as opposed to the way one is in sickness.
Yeah, that's something that I guess all of us, if we admit it, have inside of us. Either a voice or voices that tell us things that other people can't know. And then the epigraph from William Osler. Do you want to read that? Do you have that handy? Do you have the book handy so you can show it up?
I do. I do have one handy. As it turns out, ask not what disease the person has, but rather what person the disease has.
In researching that, I was looking at his other quotes, and he also says, and this could apply to you, the person who takes medicine must recover twice, once from the disease and once from the medicine.
That's really true, yes.
So tell us why and how, because it really struck me. I've never thought about it before, how your definition of suicide, and even the subtitle makes it sound as if you might already be dead, how your definition of suicide differs from the one that we would normally assume to be true.
Well, I think that popularly, we think of suicide as a kind of an unfortunate accident or a consequence of depression, of disease. I came to this from a different perspective because I began to believe that the suicide wants to live and not die. And once we have that understanding, we can think in terms of a different kind of disease, one in which we're not in control of what's going on.
Well, and we can talk as we move along about how you felt when you were hanging from the fire escape, if you will. But what I went back to, like I said about reading your work, in the middle of a very successful literary career, you somehow kind of meandered, or, you know, you fell back into something, kind of in your own words, that had chased you all of your life. Why did it happen when you'd been so successful before?
Well, I think, and what I tell myself is it is because it happened because I wrote about my mother and felt that I'd violated a number of important taboos in doing so, that I'd betrayed her and that I'd betrayed myself. It was my first experience with memoir and it didn't go well. Now, the writing was fine. The writing of it was exciting. I published pieces of it in the New Yorker as it went along, about four, and then finished it after that.
How soon after you finished it did we come to the point where you were on the roof?
Well, a little less than a year. So it took a while to build up, but it was building up already during the time that I was publishing the separate pieces of it in the New Yorker. It took a little while, but it was, I think of it as a kind of a triggering event. And it took me much longer, and after my first long hospitalization, to begin to think in terms of my own private history, or my personal history with my mother as a lifelong contributing factor, not only with my mother, but with my whole family. I mean,
yeah. Well, that's, know. Yeah. Talk a little bit about, I mean, obviously the memoir about your mom, it's funny, you know, you wrote a memoir because you wrote a memoir. Talk about the rest of your family, because everyone's kind of, I mean, all families are dysfunctional in different ways, but yours is pretty dysfunctional.
Well, my parents were pretty fiendish alcoholics. I mean, they were strong alcoholics. So from early on in life, my sister and I lived in a world of fighting. So my parents would fight every night until 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning, almost every night during growing up. And that's a bit of a shock. Right there. I used to run out into their fights and try to stop them. My sister retreated back into her room. So we had very different coping strategies. She and I are friends now, but for a long time, our family life drove us apart. We were highly out of touch, as it were.
You know, when I first started college, this neoliberal college, actually the only university in the country that would take me, our first year was...
I know the feeling.
They only graduated me from a high school just to get rid of me. I don't think I ever had enough credits. But our first year's curriculum, because it was like Goddard or Franconia, the curriculum for everything was nature versus nurture. And nurture seems to be the driving force here. But how do you feel about nature, about genetic predisposition to these types of situations?
I don't know the answer.
No,
you know?
No. Yeah.
I don't know the answer. I don't think we really know. You know, I don't think medicine really knows the answer to that for suicide.
You know, I just saw the other day, I was in New York, and now that Broadway's open, I saw American Utopia with David Byrne, who I love. And he said something at the outset, he's holding this brain, and he says that infants have 100 billion neurons when they're born, which is twice as many as adults, in a brain that's half the size. And that's why I asked that question, because, you know, it's like idea of the Buddha baby, and there you are, this tabula rasa, and then what got imprinted on you for the most part wasn't that great.
No, it wasn't. I guess when I think about nature versus nurture, I think that they're fundamentally the same in some way.
Yeah. I can see that. Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I don't, you know, and like you just said, we don't know. We don't know the answer to that. I mean,
right.
I've interviewed lots of authors who've written about consciousness. Oh, that was a question I was going to ask you. I get them mad because I always ask them, what if it was a solipsistic universe? And they get mad because that screws up their entire theory of consciousness. And there was a point in the book where you kind of touched on that maybe it was just you, you know, alone on this endless strand, this endless beach, and there's nothing else but just you.
You mean when I'm sick?
Yeah.
Yeah, my sense of that was that time took on a different kind of gravity or weight, that time changed. I felt that I was in a sort of an eternity. I was you know, for a long time, I would try to sleep and not be able to, but in the hopes that in the morning it would all change, that it would all be different, that I would be back to normal. But that never happened. It got worse and worse and worse. And I began to believe that I would never escape the illness, that this was it. That informed my thinking about all this, was the way in which, in the state of suicide, life becomes a kind of eternity, or the condition becomes an eternity outside of historical time.
So to be certain, so the reader is certain, suicide is not an act that you commit. Suicide is a condition that you suffer from theoretically all your life.
That's one way of putting it. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
So I think I can't remember. Did you touch upon the Cartesian duality in the book? You did.
A little bit.
Yeah. How did the mind body, well, that goes back to nature versus nurture. Well, no, it doesn't. But how does the mind body concept, how did that play into, I mean, you know, you're an intelligent, articulate person, so that must have played into some of your normal psyche and also the delusional one.
I was physically sick. When I was in the hospital, I was so sick that I believed that I was in the wrong hospital. I believed that I was being held captive by my doctors, by my psychiatrists, who didn't understand that my real illness was in my body, that I should be in a different hospital, a general hospital. I had constant tingling in my extremities. I had a feeling that my chest was compressed, that there was a great weight on it. I was in a state of a kind of shock. Now, I was medicated and I was calm some of that time, but I was sicker and sicker. And I mean, at several points I demanded that the internist come over from Columbia to the New York State Psychiatric Institute, where I was in residence for almost four months, and check me out. And he would check me out and tell me that I was fine, that I didn't have any physical maladies. And then I would feel better for a few minutes. And then after I left the office, the medical checkup office, it would all return. And I was weaving down the halls. I couldn't walk straight. So my balance was off. Pardon?
One of the most striking examples of that was when you kind of felt like your shoulders were kind of like dislocated.
Right.
And you had a confrontation with a bunch of people, and they seemed to be taken aback, almost afraid of you.
Well, I must have looked pretty bad to them. And at that point, that was only about a week and a half or 2 weeks before I went to the hospital, maybe even less. I was hospitalized after my trip to the roof, which was where the title comes from, one Friday in April. And then talked my way out after just a weekend. And then 5 weeks later, I was so sick that I went back into the hospital. But before that happened, before I went uptown to stay for a long time, I had this episode with my shoulders. They felt like they were rotating oddly in the sockets, and that they would come out of my, you know, that they would fall out. And I took myself up to an orthopedic clinic on the Upper East Side, where I think I must have scared people. I was, you know, I was dizzy. I was wild-eyed. I was wearing clothes that must have seemed to be a couple of sizes too big because I'd lost so much weight. You know, they could see it. They could see that I wasn't well. But I was there. At that point, I was definitely in the wrong doctor's office.
Yeah, and everyone kind of said, hey, you're fine. What about the people who read this book who may think, you know what, why didn't he just do it? You know, why is he telling us all this stuff? Why didn't he just let go? And you kind of say, because you didn't want to die.
No, I didn't want to die. I was just up there. I found myself on the fire escape. Or I ran up and ran to the fire escape and climbed a few steps down and then hung off of it.
Yeah, but your hands were raw. You were in your socks and you were hanging, and then you kind of like, well, it's hard for me to understand why you didn't at that moment, just at some moment. And that you even say on the way down, if you let go on the way down, you might go, oh, shit, why did I do this?
Right.
But it's just, what is it? What is that little thingy that makes you stay on? What is that little thing that doesn't allow you to let go, even though you're very, very close to it?
Well, I didn't want to die, and I stayed up there on the fire escape for a long time. And after some amount of time, I got up, I climbed back up and got onto the roof itself, where I crawled around and roamed around and looked over the various edges. And I wouldn't get too close to the edge because I was afraid of heights. I'm afraid of heights. So I think I just stayed long enough for the moment to pass. I knew when I was on the roof that if I were to come down, I would wind up in the hospital, and I was terrified of the hospital. You know, I thought that I would be put away forever, that I would never get out, or at least that it would take years to recover. And it took me about 5 hours to come down from the roof. It went from day to night. And when I came down, my girlfriend and a couple of other friends were waiting in the apartment, and they just swept me off, took me in a car to the hospital for my first short visit.
Yeah, that reminds me. You had a really good loyal, because I might have abandoned you, support group of friends.
Right. I did.
And your girlfriend, Reagan?
Reagan.
Yeah, I mean, they really hung, and you weren't that great to her in a lot of ways.
No, I wasn't. I was very sick at that time, and I wasn't. I was quite out of my mind, really. But going back to your question about what enabled me to survive, I don't know the answer to that either. You know, I don't really know. I thought that I should live. I thought that I should give it a try. But that took a long time to come to on the roof. I mean, it seemed, again, things seem eternal in that illness. And that seemed like an eternity that I was on the roof. Well, and when I finally came back down the stairs, I was full of dread. You know, I didn't want to face what was coming.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying, well, why don't you just let go? All the dread would go away. Everything would go away. That's where I'm a little confused, because it's obviously you're hanging there. It's totally pivotal, not only to your life, but to this work. So you're hanging there, you're almost letting go, but you want to live. And it almost seems like the juxtaposition is impossible or improbable. I don't mean to push you too hard on this, but still.
I almost did let go, and I could have let go.
Right.
It was very close.
There never was this feeling that I would rather there be nothing or whatever comes after than what I'm going through now. Because as you keep saying, you were very, very sick and full of dread.
There was that feeling. I did have that feeling. And I flirted with it. I kept letting go with one hand.
Yeah.
And then I found that I would catch myself. I was leaning out over it, hanging from the railing. And I would catch myself with the hand that let go, usually my left hand. And maybe that was how I wound up coming back up the ladder to the roof. You know, I didn't do it after a certain amount of time. And so I came back up to consider. I couldn't really consider much. I couldn't really think about it very much. But I came back up to wait a minute before I did it. I was afraid. I was afraid to fall. You know, and I was afraid not to. It's a terrible predicament, and somebody else might not make it. You know, I did. I made it back up, and I made it to the hospital for that first trip. I kept taking care. I kept, you know, I took myself to the hospital the second time, the long hospitalization. Why did I do that? You know, so I was even sicker by then. I couldn't function at all. I was sleep deprived. I was dizzy. I hurt everywhere.
What's the book that you talk about that I've read, but I forgot the title, by William Styron?
darkness visible.
Yeah. And that's where I first understood, I think, and you use it as a gnomon of understanding. That's where I first understood the concept of suicide not being the act. And I don't know if that's something that you, if it's derivative or it's seminal on your part in this book. Is it? Did you come up with it, do you think?
Well, I think I came up with it in my own terms, through my own experience, but I owe a debt to darkness visible, absolutely.
Yeah, when I realized, well, one, how much it affected other people, two, how it wasn't, he was trying to explain, well, it's not just being depressed, it's something way, way different than that. Oh yeah, which reminds me, why did you go through that semi-Joycean litany of, for want of a better term, the blues? You know, a page of what this is called. What were you trying to tell us?
Just trying to drive it in. You know, how many different ways we have of describing it. You know, how many different terms, where they come from, how different they are in reality, but how we interchange them. Just making a larger point about it instead of simply saying we have a lot of ways of talking about suicide. It seemed to me that it would be good to elaborate on that, or to enumerate some of the ways.
It was good. It gave a lot of perspective, I believe. And let's move on to what's kind of an integral part of the whole book, which is your various medications. I'm not asking for a litany of those, but a summary of what they were, how they worked, what didn't work, because that's one of the things that I think the reader can take away from this, especially readers who find themselves essentially calling you as a suicide hotline.
Well, during that time, during that early period, I had tried a variety of medications, but I was resistant to them. So I was taking Klonopin, benzodiazepine, for anxiety. And that was making things worse, much as Halcyon made things worse for William Styron. So I wasn't medicated. I wasn't really medicated. I was on the one anti-anxiety medication, but I wasn't medicated on antidepressants. Now I am, you know, time has passed. And I was after the hospital, after ECT, I was medicated on lithium and nortriptyline, which is an older generation antidepressant.
Yeah, both are. Yeah, that goes into the stigmatized concept of electroconvulsive therapy, which, you know,
right.
Everyone is repelled by because it's shock therapy and, you know, like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and what happens to Jack Nicholson.
Exactly.
Yeah, so talk about why that, if you think that it actually was helpful. It was at one time.
ECT?
Yeah.
Saved my life.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Saved my life. And I think it's a very strong measure against suicide. I was terrified of it. I saw it coming. And I thought that I would lose everything. I thought that I would lose my writing. I thought that I would lose my ability to think. I thought that I would lose my ability to function. I was very bought into that idea, that older idea about the dangers of ECT and shock therapy. And I went into it. I proceeded with it with tears. You know, I didn't believe that I would be okay at all. And in that first trip to the hospital, I had about 18 rounds of it. So about 9 or 10 rounds and nothing happened. And then about 8 more. And then it took hold. And I began to walk straight and I began to be able to hold my head up. And my voice changed. It got deeper and I had more resonance more body in the sound coming from my chest. It saved my life.
There were three interesting things about that scene, if you will. One, the woman who came in, the doctor who came in, was dressed in the business suit and seemed very professional, was very self-assured. And secondly, was when you peeled, you know, how they moisturize and you peeled that off. That was very, made it really real. And the third thing, which is the saddest for me, is the fact that David Foster Wallace called you up and talked to you about it and said, yeah, do it. And then, of course, he stops taking his Nardil, and he's the one who actually does kill himself.
Yes, that's right. At the end of a long drug trial, a nortriptyline trial, nortriptyline by itself, with a little Seroquel thrown in for anxiety, the doctors took me into a meeting, and the chief ECT doctor said to me that I was very sick, that I was psychotic, and I objected. I was in tears telling her and the room other reasons that I ruined my life in this way and that. But she said, we want to give you ECT. It will help you. It won't hurt you, but we need your consent. And I left the room without giving my consent and wept my way around the halls and asked the residents and doctors there if they would do ECT. And they said, yes, if I were as sick as you, I would do it. And I think it was later that same day, but it may have been a day or two later. The phone rang and the patient phone rang and someone called my name and I went to the phone and it was David Wallace.
Did you know him before?
I'd met him, but I didn't know him. We'd met years before. He said, a mutual friend has told me about your situation and he asked how I was doing and how long I'd been there. And I told him, and he just said right off the bat, if they offer you ECT, I want you to do it. And so he had a role in saving my life, you know. He stayed on the phone with me a good long time and told me over and over that I would be safe, told me that he had done it 20 years before, that it got better as a treatment since that time. And it was after that phone call that I was able to give my consent to go to the doctors and say, I'm ready to do this.
Did you ever take what he took, which was Nardil?
No, I never took that. I never took that.
And then that one, I guess that day he had a stomach ache, stopped taking it, and that was the day he did it. And all of these medications increase the likelihood of suicide in the traditional sense. You know, you become more cognitively aware of yourself and you have the ability to actually act out. Is that something that actually, did that happen? Did you get to a point where some of these medicines made you feel well enough to realize, hey, I can go through with this?
No, that never happened with me. Okay. I'm medicated now on several medications and I feel very stable. I feel, for want of a better way of putting it, I feel almost normal, you know?
I feel pretty
normal.
Well, that's the thing about writers, really good writers. Most of them aren't really normal, whether it's Franz Kafka or James Joyce or Faulkner or anybody, or David Foster Wallace or Jonathan Franzen.
Well, who's normal then?
I don't know. That's like the Cartesian duality in nature versus nurture. I know I don't want to be normal. I know that. I've always known that. It just seems very boring, but I don't know. Oh yeah, well, I guess that goes to, okay, if you feel close to normal now, why do you? Is it the medication? In the book, you make it clear that your wife has made a big difference in this.
Oh yeah.
And that's something totally that I don't think you could really have expected. But do you think it's a combination of things? Do you think you made a cognitive decision? See, you always seem to be cognitively aware of things in the book. And your memory of each of those things seems very clear and lucid. That was a conundrum for me. How do you remember everything?
Well, I don't remember everything. And a lot of my experience is not there. It's not in the book. I had years to think about it and years to try to remember and years of therapy where I talked about it, and good medication helped. I wasn't able to write this book for a long time. I began to think about it during my first hospitalization.
Really?
If I ever got through this, that one day I would have to write about it. I didn't want to write about it, but I thought I would have to. And it took over 10 years for me to begin. And I think that without my wife in the room with me, as it were, I don't think I'd have been able to do it. I was alone for a long time before she came into my life. And I couldn't really write then, but what I could do was think about it. And I thought about it obsessively. And for years, up until about 2016, 2017, if you had known me, you would have heard about suicide from me. You'd have heard all about it. I would have collared you and told you my ideas and said, what do you think? Does that make sense to you? So I had occasion to remember, you know, and also I think the act of writing makes some memory possible. Once I had certain memories or had certain parts of the book written, I was able to go from there as if I were triggered into better memory. But I also know that I'm fallible and that I'm doing my best to remember. I want the reader to understand that I'm operating in good faith, you know?
Yeah, and that's a good point. It's also interesting that during the time that you were in the worst condition, you said you actually admit you couldn't write. You would write little notes once in a while, but you couldn't write.
Right, I would write suicide notes. Basically,
that would be an interesting collection.
Well, they weren't really very interesting. They were never very long. They were apologies to Reagan. And I usually didn't finish them. And I would write them during the afternoon. I would write them sitting on a tarp that I dragged out of from under the bed. I'd drag it out here into the living room. And spread it out on the floor. And I would bring out a knife and my pills, thinking that I would take the pills and then slit my wrists. And so the tarp was so that it would be easy to clean up the mess. And then I would write, I had a pen and a piece of paper. I would write notes until she got off work, at which point I would ball them up and bury them in the trash and put the tarp back and put the knife back in the kitchen drawer.
Talk about that knife, because it's the Sabatier knife.
Right. That I brought from home. It's a knife that I brought from home. And it may or may not be, but there was a night when I was 10 years old and we were living in Charlottesville, Virginia, where my father was a professor. And my sister and I were upstairs in our bedrooms listening to the fighting, and my mother screamed that my father had a knife and that he was going to kill her. And I don't know if that was true or not. I didn't go downstairs, but it would have been one of his, he was a cook, so it would have been one of his paring knives or something like that. And I later took one when I went away to college. Or when I went away to college and I was living on my own off campus, I took from the kitchen drawer. So I suppose in the book that it's possibly the same knife, because there were only a few.
Did you imply that you're still living in the same place now that you were when all this happened?
Yeah. Yeah, I live here.
Is that difficult? I guess it's not.
No. No. It might be better to be somewhere else, but I'm at peace with it here.
Go ahead. When you talk about your travels, it was fascinating to me because I lived in Gainesville for 29 years, 5 months and 10 days, went to the University of Florida and went to law school there.
Oh, really?
So where did you live in Gainesville?
I don't remember the street, but it was near the campus. It was near the golf course.
Oh, I know exactly where you were then.
Yeah.
You know, all those little houses that were along the street, there were all the concrete block ones.
Second Street or Second Avenue or somewhere like that.
Yeah, I was near my law office, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, Gainesville has grown tremendously. You should go back there. It's amazing.
I have been back. I went down there to do a reading a few years ago at the MFA program. And I don't really remember it from childhood, though I did go back to my old elementary school, which is now contains the offices for the school, the district school board.
Kirby Smith.
That's it. Yeah.
That's where my ex-wife first started teaching, and I would go in and play with the kids and she would kick me out. Yeah. Kirby Smith.
Yeah. And I found the church where my parents were remarried. They divorced and married again 2 years later in Gainesville.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, you were saying how traumatized you were by writing a memoir about your mom. Yet, you know, it's like jumping into this ice cold water. But then here you are again, like you said, doing the same thing.
I began that memoir with about my mother the year after she died. I really wasn't prepared to do it. This time around, I took a long time. And I figured I'd survive memoir once and I could do it again. And this turned out to be true. I'm not having a shakeup at this point from this book. I'm glad to be publishing it.
Yeah, me too. Oh yeah, that was what I was going to ask too. All right, yeah, it's a memoir and you wanted to get it out and it's taken all this time. But it's a book. It's in my bookstore. Well, actually today it'll be in my bookstore kind of because I would be breaking the law if I put it in yesterday. But... Yeah, so there, the reader comes in, like I said, loves the cover, looks inside, sees the epigraph. It's just, I mean, I'm just so used to this after so many years.
Yeah.
And so what do you want? I mean, do you want the reader to, is this, for want of a better term, is this designed in part to be a self-help book for other people to take away how you survived this?
Hope it helps. You know, I hope it helps. If someone needs to read something, if someone's in trouble, then anyone who is in trouble or who might be or who's lost someone to suicide reads this, then I hope it helps. But I'm not sure that it's meant to be really a self-help book so much. I'm trying to make the case, well, yeah, I mean, sure, why not? I can call it that. And I'm trying to make the case about suicide, about a rethinking of suicide. So it's meant to make a difference for people who read it in one way or another.
I think the biggest difference is the subtitle and what we started about at the outset. I think people can realize, which I never thought of in a million years, that suicide is not the act. And I think that I actually think that could have a positive influence on a lot of people. That's just my opinion. It actually did with me. You know, it's not like the stigma of suicide. This is something that's a process. You know, I had suicidal ideation when I was a little kid.
You did?
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, okay, what's the point? It wasn't as emotional as yours because I had a wonderful upbringing, great parents, but there was like kind of like Sartre and nausea. There was like this idea, what's the point? What's the essence? What am I, you know, it's, or like Kurt Cobain, like maybe, you know, hey, this is enough. I did what I'm supposed to do. I don't know. You know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
Yeah. But so what do you think would be happening to you today if you weren't on your medications?
I don't think I'd be in great shape. I might not be here. You know?
So
basically.
So I guess you're a proponent. I mean, do you think for the rest of your life? Yeah. I guess for the rest of your life, you feel like you'll be medicating.
Well, I'll be taking something. I mean, yeah. I don't feel medicated. I just feel stable. But I guess I'll be taking something, whether I'm still taking what I'm taking now. That might change.
When I was in therapy, it was really funny what this therapist, I kind of liked him. What he said was, because he was going to give me something to take. Actually, it was Klonopin or a Valium type derivative. And he said, look, I have high blood pressure. I'm taking medicine for high blood pressure. It's no different. It's exactly right. The same thing.
Right. That's how I feel about it. I mean, it's a bit of a chore taking pills every day, but I do it religiously.
Do you have it? How do you do it? I have my, do you have yours like lined up? Do you put them in one of those silly little things?
No, I just take them out of the bottles one at a time.
I don't like those things. It makes me feel old, although I am old, but you know, although I am starting to forget stuff and not sure whether I do that. I know what like Osler said about both the quote you gave and the one that I found. That's like 125 years ago that he said.
Right.
And there really wasn't all this shit that we have now. And now you have all this sophisticated kind of stuff that drills down into serotonin and epinephrine and all that stuff. But he already had this, I'll call it epiphany, that the medicine itself sometimes is worse than the cure.
Right.
So you quoted it. I mean, that was your epigraph.
Right.
It's kind of like the opposite of what you're saying now.
Well, I'm not really referring to the medicine itself in that quote. I'm referring to suicide.
Yeah, but you're acting as if the disease possesses. Yeah. You're saying the disease possesses the person rather than the person having the disease.
So correct? Many of us go through similar experiences. You know, that was one of the things that struck me in calling it a disease as opposed to an event. And again, it gets down to this question of whether the suicide wants to die. That was really the beginning for me of this book, that if the suicide doesn't want to die, then what's going on? We say all the time after losing someone, what did I not do that I could have done, or why did he do it, or why did she do it? And so I wanted to try to answer that question a little bit, you know. I mean, this book is not seeking or finding all the answers. It's proposing some new thoughts.
I've had some interesting discussions, again, because a lot of the kids who work in my bookstore are going to the STEM Academy, and they're really smart, and they're 16 or 17. And they talk about, these people have been out in where I live now, they put these signs out in their yard that says, you are enough, other things that are positive. And they all laugh about them because they say, if you're suicidal, that actually doesn't help. It kind of hurts.
Right.
You look at it and you go, actually, I don't think I am enough. And yeah, so it's like suicidal ideation. And when you wrote notes apologizing, and when you came close to it, you know, a lot of people will say, if you talk about suicide, you're not going to commit suicide.
Maybe. I mean, I'm stressing that in the book, that the suicide should tell the story. You know, that's near the close of the book. As a veteran of therapy, and therapy helped save my life too, you know, it didn't stop my hospitalizations, but it's been an important part of my life since and was before. I told my story in writing this book. I'm telling my story. You know, I think I feel healthier for having written it.
Yeah, you know what? Now I just thought of something too. If you talk about suicide the way you do, I think there's some positivity to it. So someone who does have this feeling, I should end it, actually can then realize, oh no, what it is I just have something. It doesn't mean I'm going to commit suicide. It means I am a suicide. That's
right.
What I have. It's a condition rather than an act.
Right.
I think actually that's the coolest thing about the book. And you start out with that.
Right. It took me a long time to come to that. I mean, it took me some writing to come to that. And it took me a long time to feel qualified to write this. You know, to feel that I could have something to say, that I could do it, that I could say these things. But I'm glad I did, you know.
Well, okay. I guess kind of in conclusion, because we've been chatting quite a while. So that idea that you present so cogently, was it like a light bulb that went off above your head, or was it a process that, because you're such a good writer, that's the other thing. Because you're such a good writer, is this something that you processed until you could understand it? Or was it something that was just there all along from when you were a kid and your mom and your dad and the memoir about her and all that? Or was it a one moment of epiphany?
There was a moment.
There was? When was it?
Years ago. It was while I was thinking about the book before I began to write it. And again, it came from this idea that the suicide doesn't want to die, that the suicide might die, could die, is on the way to dying, but doesn't necessarily want to die. So it all flows from that. In other words, if we think that, then we have to think in terms of a disease, and maybe one that's long-term. For me, it's longer term. It may not be as long-term for other people. There are all kinds of traumas that could contribute to suicide. The greatest trauma is what follows trauma, which is the isolation that follows trauma, the personal isolation. So that's where I was coming from.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about, because I've been through that, the isolation idea. That's when I was talking about the solipsism, is this idea that you're just alone.
Yeah.
You're just alone. There's never going to be anyone there. You're in this room, or you're on this empty place where there's nobody there for you ever.
Right. Forever. And I lived in that for quite a while. And I couldn't do much.
No, it's incredibly hard to function in that kind of situation.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I don't know if that cheers me up or makes me depressed. what about me? Anyway, so to close it out, I think that now my moment of epiphany is I think that that's what's positive about the book. And that actually is, and I don't even like the term self-help. Nobody I know likes the term, but that is what it is. It's some kid, some 17-year-old, and unfortunately, I say girl because it's usually girls in today's world that do this. And there's so much pressure. You know, if they get a B in a class instead of an A, that's
right
to tip them. And it's happened here in Philadelphia many times in the past couple of years. But yeah, I think the idea of thinking about it in terms of it not being something that you do, it's something that is with you, is inside your head, but doesn't need to be the end of your life. So it's cool. I think that's pretty cool.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, thanks for coming on and talking to me. And I think that, like I said, people should, it's still virtual, but I think people should definitely turn out at the library and see you like I'm seeing you now.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's good to You're talk welcome. To you.
Likewise. Talk to you soon, hopefully.
Okay.
Man, bye.
Bye.